guys probably feel embarrassed about having a hair loss product on their, you know, side locker. We wanted to change that. So create a brand that would make them feel okay about using those and that it's a normal thing.
How are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, my guests are Will and Adrian, the co-founders of Sons. They've raised nearly 7 million euro to completely revolutionize men's healthcare. Here's my chat with the lads. Going green, becoming more sustainable, it's everywhere, right? Everyone wants to be greener and do their bit to help. But sometimes, for your business, there are more important things to do. It's hard to find the time. Well, take it out of your hands because it's all in a day's work for your local enterprise office. They have the time and the experts to sort it for you. And the best bit is, it'll help your business, save you time, money, and energy. Perfect, right? The Green for Business audit will assess your business and tell you where you can make changes. And the new energy efficiency grant will help you pay for those changes. And your local enterprise office will sort the whole process for you. Go to www.allinadayswork.ie/green, fill out the form that takes less than 2 minutes, and your local enterprise office will take it from there. Going green? It's all in a day's work for your local enterprise office. Many of you listening to the pod are business owners and savvy investors, but have you been introduced to peer-to-peer lending? Peer-to-peer lending is the practice of lending money directly to other individuals or businesses without the need for a traditional intermediary like a bank. Property Bridges offers you the opportunity to lend directly to experienced home builders across Ireland through their innovative online investment platform. Investors earn returns of up to 9% per annum, and your money is fully secured against property. To learn more, visit propertybridges.com. Property Bridges is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Before we dive into today's episode, I want to share a game changer for your business, Azure Communications. When it comes to print and marketing solutions, these folks, led by CEO Jenny Johnston, are the real deal. Whether you need an eye-catching brochure, sleek business cards, or a full-blown digital campaign, Azure Communications has you covered. They're not just about high-quality prints or digital campaigns, they're also about delivering great results. And here's the best part. Just for listeners of the Entrepreneur Experiment, you can get 20% off your first order. Just give them a call or go online and use the code FOX20. With personalized service and fast turnaround times, Azure Communications will help you make the impact your business deserves. Trust me. When it comes to making your brand stand out, Azure Communications is the provider of choice. Check them out at azurecom.ie. Use code FOX20 and elevate your marketing game today.
Will, Adrian, welcome to the pod.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Gary.
Really looking forward to it.
Yeah, good to be here.
One of those duo podcasts.
Yeah. You said we'd make life a little harder for you.
Yeah, make me work for it. Introduce yourselves. What do you guys do?
So I'm Will, one of the founders, and Adrian is the other half of Sons. We're a men's healthcare brand. We provide clinically proven products for male pattern hair loss and for scalp health.
Brilliant. So how'd you get started?
Our journey, I suppose, comes from myself and Adrian's friendship. We met in London 12 and a half years ago at this stage, and we became very close friends over there. And went through a very common experience of starting to lose our hair around 18, I think, and both happened to go to a clinic in London for that.
And I think from my side, coming from a medical background, going to a hair clinic, you're probably expecting it to be very medical focused, you know, meeting a doctor. But in fact, it was the opposite. Very sales driven, very focused on, you know, how can I sell you a product rather than how can I help you? And even the overall experience of going to a waiting room, you know, at that time I was very embarrassed. I was shy about it. And you're sitting in a waiting room worried if someone that you know will walk in. And then we thought, you know, we had a real opportunity to change that.
And like, go back to how you guys met. Were you mates in London? You just bumped into each other. How'd you guys get to know each other?
It was friends of friends in London, moved over around the same time.
Were you working together?
No
social circle. So I think like a lot of people, Irish people who moved to London, we seemed to gravitate towards all the Irish, and then mutual friends knew each other. And then we started to play sport together, go to the pub most weekends and, you know, got to know each other from there.
What were you doing over there?
At the time I was working with Kerry Group in London. So I had roles in commercial and then business management with them. And, you know, probably, you know, going back, you know, would have always probably had an entrepreneurial interest. And I think, you know, at the time of going to that clinic, probably just really the problem or the opportunity was very evident coming out of that. Our timing was very coincidental, right? You know, we happened to be in a pub in South London, got a few pints in and shared our experience. And, you know, that's probably the different skill sets then. Adrian's background, you know, as a scientist and working in the pharma industry, able to identify that the products the clinic was offering were off patent and they were very highly priced. My angle looking at it to go, actually, did you need to go to the clinic? Was the diagnostic relevant there? You know, so you could remove the clinic and do that online. And the real unlock is that, right, it's a stigmatized area of health, hair loss, you know, and an undertreated area for guys. So a brand would be the unlock for that. You know,
and how did you talk about starting something? Because, like, were you just having a pint and decided, oh, let's have a crack at this? Or what was the, oh, you know, we should do this? Like,
yeah, I think we both had thought about it probably separately. And I had a conversation to another friend about the challenges I had underwent. And I was kind of like, the frustrations, why did I have to go and see a doctor? Why did I have to, you know, go and collect the medicines in a pharmacy, all of that? And then Will had also went through that. So then it was actually, you know, I had thought about it, but I hadn't went, okay, let's do that. And it was a Tuesday, I was in work and Will called me up and said, you know, what are we going to do about this? Are we going to, you know, do something? And then that evening we met and we started to like really share the ideas. And at that time we were both in, you know, two very busy jobs, busy lives. And we just started to really write a business plan and say, you know, where are we going to take it? So it was opportunistic and we kind of never looked back.
Had either of you started a business before?
I hadn't, but Will had some interesting experience.
Not with any structure. you know, I had my final year of college, I took a lease in a pub with a number of friends. So we ran that for a couple of years.
Did not expect you to say that. Say more about that.
That was a lot of fun.
Where was it? You
know, it was in Cork. The pub was the Thirsty Scholar at the time, and we took the lease and then we renamed it the Star, which is the Western Star. Had recently closed down, which would be a kind of very synonymous pub in kind of student life in Cork. We had a very busy student bar for a couple of years, and it's not our fault that students don't spend money.
How did you end up even coming across that? Like, how did you end up leasing a pub?
There was a number of us working for another guy who had a couple of pubs at the time. I was, you know, actually doing the bouncer on the door for it, and you know, we were probably I'd say we had a good network in the college. You know, we played a lot of Gaelic football. And he kind of came up with the opportunity for us to go in on the pub with him, and we did that. So I suppose there was a bit of double jobbing with doing the my final exams in commerce and having the pub as well, but it worked out okay.
That sounds like sounds like a bad mix, to be fair. Student and job. Owns the pub.
Yeah.
Too many free drinks, maybe.
A bit of that. Yeah.
Where are you from, Cork?
From Dublin originally, but okay. Moved to Cork when I was 15.
Okay.
So I spent about 8 years and I love Cork. You know, a lot of my best friends are down there now. So unfortunately, I was at the game at the weekend, didn't go our way.
That's what we needed. We have a rabid Cork listenership that just, they love anything to do with Cork. So there's our angle, right? There's our hook for this episode.
I'm happily give Cork a massive plug anytime.
Adrian, where are you from?
Monaghan. So lived there my whole life. Played Gaelic football growing up, did a lot of athletics, and then moved to Dublin to UCD for college. And then actually the reason I went to London initially was I did my PhD there and then started my career. So I was consulting in pharmaceuticals, always been in the healthcare industry. And then the last role I had before Sons was with Ernst & Young in the corporate finance team. Again, always healthcare focused, pharmaceutical focused. So that's, I suppose, been some of the knowledge I've had in terms of, I wouldn't have had consumer brand experience, but actually understanding how you can roll out an operational model and some of the less cool stuff in the business, but important is where I get stuck in.
And how did you feel about starting a business? Because that sounds like quite a traditional structured background. How did you kind of square that circle in your head?
Yeah, like I would be lying if I said it was easy. I definitely thought about it a lot. You've worked pretty hard from your education up to get into a very structured reliable role, knowing where your monthly paycheck will always come from. But as we started to get in for the information and digging and really seeing the opportunity, you know, at that time, didn't have dependents. You know, we weren't married. I didn't have a kid. It was the perfect time to do it. And I think it really, really helped the fact that there was two of us, because you felt a safety net knowing the other person was there. You could bounce ideas and you kind of knew you were in it together. So if it didn't work out,
the other one must surely know what's going on, because I don't.
Just to clarify, we're not married.
Yeah.
Separately married. I think one of the things we did early on with the idea was we got a survey out to about 100 lads. And I think that was kind of one of the advantages of being the lived experience and being very close to the customer, is we were able to say, you know, this is what we're thinking of doing. You know, is this something that you think about, you know, hair loss, and do you take treatments? And that survey came back kind of pretty resounding that, you know, you had probably, you know, 70 of the 100 people thinking about it, you know, maybe 15 to 20 people doing something about it. So immediately there we saw, right, there's something in this. And
is that how you tested the concept for sons?
Earlier, like in terms of like within the first few days, yes.
Deadly.
And I think that'd be like, you know, advice I'd part to any person starting off, is like really try and validate the problem or the opportunity that you're going after. And you know, you can do that, you know, for free and very easily with, you know, your network, or, you know, network that you find through, I don't know, LinkedIn, wherever it is.
It's never been easier, and it's a step most people skip because they're afraid to hear no. They're afraid to hear it's a fucking terrible idea. Don't do it. How else did you validate? Because this is obviously a podcast called The Entrepreneur Experiment. I believe like business is just a series of experiments run over and over until you find the winning one. How else did you validate the idea?
I think from a medical and a clinical perspective, we also had found in that survey that people had tried products and they hadn't worked. So from my background, being a PhD scientist and really, you know, wanting to understand the evidence, we identified the two clinically proven products for hair loss, and working very closely with our medical director, who had a lot of experience, Dr. Knut Moe, working in the hair loss space itself, we validated that we knew these products could work. So we get results in over 90% of men, you know, 80% can see regrowth. So we knew we had a product that would help people with their hair loss, and we knew that there was a real interest there.
And we could validate there was like millions of people using the two clinically proven products, but no brand bringing them together and offering them to them. So you had like big brand incumbents like Regain, that's been around since 88, or on the prescription side, Propecia from Merck, but no one bringing the two of those together, and those products work synergistically. So
okay,
that I think, you know, we could see that there was, you know, proof that there was a customer there and a lot of people using them. And I suppose what we were doing is making it more accessible, but also then offering treatment plans that were delivering better efficacy for the patient.
So what was the biggest problem as you saw it? Like what main thing were you trying to solve?
Untreated population really around it, like, and what's the, a lot of that we felt was around access to the treatments, and that could be how convenient it is or how it's priced. You know, we went back to say like the clinic we went to, the treatment's priced about 1200 quid a year.
Oof.
For us it's about 350 to 400 pounds, right? So accessibility, and then I think the other part was relatability. So guys probably feel embarrassed about having a hair loss product on their, you know, side locker. We wanted to change that, so create a brand that would make them feel okay about using those, and that it's a normal thing. So I think that was really, you know, where we saw
the, and underpinning that was the education, so making them aware that our products worked. And these were the reasons why, being really upfront around it. And if they had had a bad experience before, really letting them know why. So we've always been very education driven, medically focused, but then relatable from a brand perspective.
It's probably hard. Like, I'm going to pull up on your products here, so if you're watching YouTube, you'll be able to see it. Like, it's slick packaging. Like, it looks well. Like, I think that's, people often overlook that point of like you said, it's going to sit in your shelf all the time. You don't want to be like hiding it up the back. And like, that's, is it still a stigma?
I think definitely there's a stigma there. I suppose it's progressing in terms of younger generation are, you know, more open and more willing to talk about it. But I think it's definitely still a taboo subject. People are conscious. A stat that 70% of men's self-esteem is affected. So what we're trying to do is encourage that conversation to be open and try and, you know, make people realise they can do something about it if they want to, but they don't have to.
It's not all about taking treatments, we say. If you educate to go, if you're looking to prevent hair loss, there are treatments that work. You know, this is what they are. Or your other choices, you know, don't take them and, you know, great, shave your head and move on. You know, for me, it was my body is probably out of proportion to my head. And I think if I shaved it, I'd look like a bowling skittle. So wasn't an option for me.
We all have our reasons, right?
There's one of them.
You're a tall dude, in fairness to you. Yeah. So, like, talk to me then, because this sounds like one. I always think of, like, businesses in different categories, and I've heard investors say, well, that goes in the too hard pile. This doesn't sound like a very easy business to start, which is good and bad.
There's probably, there was a lot of hurdles there at the start from a regulatory and a pharmaceutical perspective. So within our products, we have a mixture of, you know, less regulated, which are supplements and cosmetics, shampoos, conditioners, that sort of thing, but then highly regulated medicine. So starting, we made a decision to get the licenses for those pharmaceutical products. That process can take up to 2 years. It requires a lot of capital, a lot of knowledge, but also a lot of maintenance. And then within that becomes a lot of compliance. So on a day-to-day basis, we have to operate within a structure that's very regulated and compliant versus a traditional e-commerce business. However, certain investors may view us as e-commerce. So you need to make them understand the complexity, but with complexity comes a large moat, and it makes it hard for other companies to enter our space.
What does the license mean? What do you mean you need to get a license?
So you apply for a pharmaceutical license to supply that product to patients and retailers in the market. So we went through licensing at the time when Brexit was happening. We had hoped to do like a European type approach, but then we had to get a UK license and then an Irish license. And then since then we've got Germany. So that license allows you to trade in the market, allows you to supply the product. But also from our strategy, it allows us to be multi-channel. So what I mean by that is we have a direct patient business. We have an Amazon marketplace business, and you can find us in the shelves of Boots. Our competitors didn't pursue that long capital intensive business, and they're focused on direct to patients. So that's differentiated us.
Okay. So no matter where you are, that's how I think of the podcast. I said to someone this morning over coffee, I was like, I don't really care where people are listening as long as they're listening.
Yeah.
Whether it's TikTok, whether so, the same as yourselves, you don't really mind where people are getting it. So what products do you have? So I'm holding, what am I holding here?
That's the minoxidil product. So that's a pharmaceutical product, but you can buy it in a pharmacy without a prescription. That product works by increasing your blood flow and oxygen to your scalp, and it goes alongside our prescription product. But also underneath it, and I think it's so important to say, that helps your hair come back. But our other range, which is your shampoos and your supplements, helps improve hair quality. So we try to marry it all together to, yes, get your hair back, but get it back in the best form possible.
How did you start? Like, what was the first product you got to market?
The minoxidil and also our prescription product, finasteride. I think, you know, we were very keen to follow the science. So if we're going to set up a brand at an online clinic, that you have products that are clinically proven to work. So we went down the path of getting the pharmaceutical licenses, which was, there was 18 months to launch with that. Which had a number of challenges. First of all, convincing to get a license, you have to find a manufacturer that has a dossier, and you effectively acquire that from them and then apply to the regulator. We had to convince very established pharmaceutical companies to work with us. I have a memory of flying over to Spain. We didn't even have a business name, and I visited Cantabria Labs, who are main supplier for minoxidil and have been since we started the business, and pitched to their head of business development, with just an idea, and he took a liking to us and they took a punt, and now a few years later we're their biggest client for own label in the business. So definitely convincing suppliers, but also investors to come in and say, we're going to realize revenue in 18 months.
I was going to ask you, how did you survive for 18 months? Like, how did you keep going?
I think as on our investors in the early stage, we were lucky that we identified and our backers had come from the industry of, you know, pharmaceutical industry. So they understood the process. More generalist investors in that stage were like, well, actually, what happens if you never reach that approval? Whereas actually they were able to really understand that background and that really helped us. But they definitely needed to be patient, because with anything in the pharmaceutical industries, there's delays and, you know, trying to get in your timeline. That was a challenge, but we had really supportive investors and they're still very involved with us to this day.
Did you raise money straight away when you started?
Yeah, if we had the business idea at the end of 18, we raised £1 million pounds, in 19.
Wow.
At stages along the way. And we're very fortunate, as Adrian said, to get backers in that had, built consumer health businesses from scratch into, hundreds of millions to exit, to people who had, really strong e-com investing experience, and then some who had just really good business experience and helped us with stuff like corporate governance when you're coming in green in that area. So really supportive backers that support us in 19, followed again in 21, and then a story around 22 that was a very tough year for us supported us again at the end of 22 into 23. So we've been very fortunate to have that set of investors. A lot of them are Irish.
Talk me through the raise, because £1 million when you've no product is chunky. Like, how did you know you needed to raise £1 million, and how did you go about doing it?
I think the number was derived from a business plan around kind of how do we acquire the, and get the licenses? How do we provide for stock for the other products? And then how do we commercialize the business? So we wanted to make sure we could set up our telehealth, our cloud pharmacy infrastructure, build our website. And then probably I think we looked at giving ourselves 6 to 9 months runway on marketing to try, and whether that was that there's no science behind that. That definitely got us to, we were able to buy kind of 9 to 12 months, really, on 200k MRR on monthly recurring revenue on our UK business. So I think that really started to give us conviction that there was a business in this.
And the round wasn't fully structured in that we, again, go back to our investors' support, in that some of them were willing to give their proportion of the capital, knowing that the rest would follow. So it allowed us to get on with some of the things we needed to do. And as we gained momentum and hit milestones, it was easier then to attract more capital. So again, going back to our first investors, they really have been brilliant and supported us along the way.
And where'd you find them? Because I think when people are trying to raise for the first time, they can often kind of spin their wheels a lot and spend a lot of time barking up the wrong tree. How did you find the right people to invest?
I think it was a case of through a network of meeting people and understanding, who in Ireland, probably where we had most of our network, had really strong experience in the area that we were looking to get into. And then a case of getting in front of those people through either, cold calling or through someone that we knew.
So you identified people you wanted to invest and then use your network to try get into them.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I think always being, you have to be very open to people saying no and just, moving on with it. And then as we did it more and more, there was iterations of our pitch deck and we kind of went through that process. But, you just have to get out there and ask questions, because people are very generous with their time, especially people who've had successes in the past. They're very willing to help. And I think that's a very strong attribute of Irish people as well. They want to help young Irish companies, and we find that very beneficial.
Where did you guys launch first? Was it UK or Ireland?
UK.
UK.
UK. And was that strategic because the market's much bigger?
Not strategic in that we hoped we would launch them both at perfect timing. But reverting back to the pharmaceutical side and Brexit, we had two applications running, one with the Irish regulator, one with the UK regulator, and it just happened that the UK licenses were approved faster. And then from there, we just moved the Irish market soon after.
200k MRR, so it's just running around in my head. How the hell did you get to that so fast?
Well, 3 months in, we thought we were toast because, you know, COVID hit. So we
3 months in.
So we built, you know, this is like the, we launched in Jan 20. So we just thought something would break along the supply chain. You know, that was our fear, like the factories won't be producing or the pharmacy won't be able to stay open. And we were very fortunate that they remained open. And then what we found was, you know, from a consumer side of things, and I'm sure you'd be aware of this, Gary, is like at that time, you know, people were, you know, at home with more disposable income and, you know, certainly probably more time to think about personal care. That benefited us. And we were able to find kind of really successful acquisition channels at that time. We opportunistically created a TV ad as well, kind of 3-4 months in, because people were at home watching TV. That went really well. There was kind of a double effect with, right, we're in healthcare, so trust is such a big factor, particularly if you're doing it online. So TV as a medium was, you know, help build that trust. And then, you know, we saw our performance marketing channels become really efficient in parallel to that.
Wow. So the two of them worked well together.
Yeah.
TV ad is ballsy though. A couple of months in, like that's big money, I would imagine.
It was in the context of the size of the business. Yeah, it was. It was definitely a punt, one that paid off. We did bootstrap the production. I did the voiceover, recording it under my covers so at home. So like, look, we were creative about how we did it. But
and where did the ad run then?
We would run. It still runs. Albeit we have a new one coming out in September, but it still runs. We'd run about 110 slots a day in the UK,
wow,
predominantly across Sky, and then in Ireland we'd run probably about 20-30 slots against same channels.
Wow! How do you know it's working?
I mean, there's attribution models you can put on it. We use a tool called TV Squared that you can understand, basically attract someone if they come to the site within a period of time after the ad. That's it. Probably can be 50 to 60% right. But I think with all attribution, you do it blended. You bring everything together and see if it's working, and then you switch it off and see what the effect is. So we've kind of trialed it along the way.
Right.
But overall, it's been an effective medium for us.
That's a cool insight, because that's something you don't really hear very often anymore. I can count on one hand how many times people have said they're doing TV ads or radio ads. So you find it's still having an impact to cut through?
Yeah, I think relative to, again, go back to, like, you know, if we look at, like, we're a healthcare business, right? You know, we're positioned as a lifestyle brand, but, you know, I think it's important to drive, you know, if to drive trust. I think TV is a medium where you can do that. And I think that people aren't aware that you can do TV you can be creative with the costs, you know, to get onto TV in terms of production, and then in terms of, you know, ads. I think a lot of the time people maybe, they might meet an agency that kind of put a cost in front of them that might be intimidating. But if you, like, we would have shopped around a lot and met different agencies. We had one that presented us, a London agency, was 5x the cost of an agency in Scotland. So we obviously went with the...
And back then, we only had our own direct-to-patient websites, but now the fact that we're in over 1,000 distribution points with people like the leading retailers like Boots, it just means you're creating brand awareness. And I think you can't underestimate the amount of people that probably know the brand from the TV ad. You know, when you're in general conversations, people are like, oh, I've seen you at the football, or I've seen you at the golf. So you try and meet men where they hang out, and we do know sports is a really good medium for that.
So you run the ads around sports, is it?
Yeah, we would have done like profiling to try and reach the target customer. You know, when we started got our marketing strategy in place, and we would have profiled, like, you know, you could have taken an F1 fan, right? And we would have then looked at running, we ran ads across F1. We then would have worked with all the F1 podcasts.
Right.
And then we look at kind of getting influencers, right? We weren't able to afford the F1 drivers, but you're looking at basically, again, in that interest base, influencers, then layer that down, performance marketing.
Cool.
So that is how we would kind of we still run our marketing strategy a lot. We look at a demographic, and then we'll look at, you know, where do they hang out, and then try and show where they are across in, you know, whether it's offline or online.
Deadly. So you'll pick, like, kind of like, specific types of people and then build a profile around them and then build your marketing around that using, that's really cool. That's right, really interesting. I like that. What worked for you early? Like what channels worked? Obviously TV played a huge part. What else was working? Obviously this is during COVID, so it's slightly dated now maybe, but we'll talk about now and then. Yeah. So what was working back then?
Yeah, there's definitely a difference, you know, in terms of, you know, the what's happened with stuff like Meta between then and now, but you know, that was extremely effective at the time, you know, still is very important, but just isn't nowhere near as efficient, and a very different channel now. Google is, I think for us, has always been steady, right? It's a shopping center where people are going into, they know what they're looking for. Mm. So that's been, you know, an effective channel for us. I think we've always done a lot with influencers, probably more at the you know, smaller micro level, where we found, you know, seeding products and then working with them for a period of time. They document their journey and show the results, and then their audience buy in. We've seen that as being effective. And then, you know, we mentioned TV, I suppose, you know, SEO as an online business obviously is something, you know, that you have to invest heavily in.
And then 2024, skip forward to now, what channels do you find are working right now in 2024?
Yeah, I think probably what's the other channel I probably missed there is we do a lot with, you know, in referral. And, you know, we work with the likes of hair transplant clinics would probably deliver kind of 10 to 15% to customers for us each month. That's a really strong channel. We've been doing a bit of work with barbers, you know, naturally that's a word of mouth piece. Mm. And we want to do a lot more there. So I think referral is a big channel for us. You know, that versus, you know, now versus then, you know, Meta is still very important.
What changed? You said now versus then, what was the difference now?
Within that channel specifically. Yeah. So I suppose that, you know, looked at the tracking and then the ad tool is less efficient, you know, with the changes that were made in 21. And also you could probably have a bit of secret sauce in having a really good paid performance team that are running the ad platform. I think now it's the Facebook algos are doing a lot of that work. So that's no longer, you know, a USP for your business. So we are now repositioning, or have repositioned our team more towards creative. So it's all about, you know, producing content at pace and then, you know, iterating and trying to scale that on the platform. So I think that's probably been one big change in terms of how we market. TikTok is obviously another channel that, again, is something that we're investing a lot in. And, you know, that ad platform, it's getting there. It's definitely something, you know, if you look at where the younger demographic are hanging out, you know, it's somewhere where you have to be. So it's something that we're investing a lot in.
And the growth and reach there is incredible. Go on
back
ahead,
then, when we, you know, when it was COVID, we had a very small team, and as we grew quite quickly, we were having to move quick in terms of getting agencies in place. And I suppose from then and now, we've transitioned away from using agencies, which were brilliant at the time, to now having a lot of team in house, and that allows people to live and breathe the idea every day and really execute and own it, versus an agency who has 10 clients and they have a lot of things to balance. So I think having a lot of that knowledge in-house now is really benefiting us, and the marketing team are excelling and doing lots of really creative things. And as Will said, really excited about our TV ad that's coming out in September.
Okay, we'll have to roll that at some stage during the pod. Talk to me then about, like, the two of you. Like, why do you have a co-founder? Because sounds like a great idea, and it sounds like you kind of jointly came up with it, but would you ever have done this on your own?
This thing specifically, I think it actually required both of us, because we both had ideas on it, but we needed to share the knowledge. And for me, the co-founder model has worked really, really well, because I, you know, we do different things and you always know you have someone there to kind of bounce ideas on. So for me, that co-founder element has worked really, really well.
And then in terms of raising the money, I want to go back to kind of like, you'd raised the million and that kind of got you so far. But like, you've raised multiple times since, you've said there, like, what was the thinking behind that? Was that like required? Was that something you did to scale? What was the thinking behind raising multiple times?
Yeah, I think the funding's a lot of it to just to keep scaling and growing the business. We had, you know, from launching in 20 to, we would have said we got proof of concept the end of that year. We took more money in from our seed investors in form of a loan note, which kind of we were using a lot of that to build the business to a certain level and also build more territories. So we were kind of, we had UK and Ireland going, and then it was about another big European market, which was Germany, still very much so in our plan, and we've launched it successful there. But if we rewind back, this is kind of end of 21. We invested a lot in getting that market going, and we were speaking to, you know, we had tripled the business in 21. We were speaking to a number of venture funds in the UK. We're at term sheet stage. So we were probably, which is unlike Adrian and myself, we were probably more focused on revenue as opposed to profitability. I think we both come from a background in business, you know, certainly for myself, and Kerry Group is, you know, was always very focused on both metrics. And we were looking at that, and then we had the case of the war and, you know, in Ukraine, and the term sheets with the venture funds, they were just pausing on investing, you know, really across the board, not just in our sector, to see how things would evolve. That put us in a position in 22 where we were looking at, you know, it was March, we probably had about 6 months runway without any access to capital. And it was at a time where, you know, as I'm sure you'll know, things to raise money was very difficult. So that was a very difficult year for us. I think going back on, you know, having a co-founder, we probably found a lot of solace in being able to, you know, have the most difficult conversations, bounce them off each other. And
thanks for sharing that. I think a lot of people wouldn't understand, looking at a business like you going, what a successful business, they're on TV, oh my god, they're so successful. But then, like, the butterfly effect of the war starting caused this ripple effect of it losing funding, essentially. So how did you get through that?
I think we had to move quickly, and kind of, as Will said, we were focused on revenue, and then really quickly overnight we got the team to really understand that we had to go towards profitability, and we were just clear on what we needed to achieve, and we moved quick on our decisions, and then we had our investors in behind us to know this is what we need to do and how to achieve it, and probably then just having really, really clear fiscal responsibility in terms of what we spend on and what we don't. And we were able to turn things around quickly. It wasn't easy, but we were very focused on that and delivering.
Yeah. I think we were fully transparent with our team and with the investors on the position we were in and you know where we needed to go. Like, we always have a roadmap. The roadmap was still similar, but a little bit different, because we had to make more money bottom line. But we get our team together every 8 weeks, and we do basically a full team session on full P&L we're fully transparent with the full P&L and how we're tracking against our roadmap goals, which are usually done out by quarter for 12 to 18 months. So we sat down with the team and said, this is where we need to get to in the next 6 months. You know, how are we going to do that? And in fairness, a great reaction from the team when we shared the position we were in. You know, we got everyone kind of binding in together rather than anyone getting, you know, wanting to leave or anything like that. And, you know, we were able to deliver profit by September, October that year.
What changes when you're going from revenue to profitability? Because I think a lot of people listening won't kind of like go, what does that mean though? But why, if they were growing like a weed, what's the difference? Like, how did you move from revenue goals to profitability goals? What did you levers you have to pull?
So first of all, we would have pulled, say, investment on. We were about to go into Germany, and, you know, any new market, you'll have to lay down a lot of, you know, investment that'll be loss making before you'll get it into profit. So that had to pause. Then it was focusing on, right, we have our UK and our Irish business. Look at the data, what products are working really well. Double down on those. What channels are working well? Double down on those. And really it was a case of just being really focused on what was working in those markets, because we could see, all right, actually within those markets, the business is close to profit. We had to pause some hiring plans for a few months as well. And I think the other piece was we were intent on going into retail anyway, but we probably accelerated that by a few months. And again, I think the retail mix with, you know, direct to consumer, it's, you know, it can, you know, it blends together and makes the P&L more healthy in terms of, you know, upfront marketing costs versus customers. So I think it was a blend of all of that. But I think go back to Testament to time, I think we were probably a team of about 8 people that really just kind of, you know, rolled up the sleeves together to do it. And delighted to say all that team are still with us today.
I love the transparency piece because I think a lot of businesses are scared. They're scared to admit what's really going on. And the result then creates this vacuum of information, which results in fear, which results in implosion. I think there's a lot of like modern entrepreneurs like you guys who are, you believe in transparency. You believe in like telling the story, being honest, bringing the team on the journey for you. At any stage at that time, were you worried it was going to come crashing down?
Yeah, you're definitely you're worried from a financial perspective in terms of, you know, as Will said, we had 6 months runway. So how are we going to get there? What do we need to do? But, you know, as Will said, we focus on the data from a marketing perspective, and operationally, we did a full review on where we could identify savings. But I don't think we ever doubted that the business and the idea wasn't still working, because we could still see that incremental growth month on month. We could still see all of that appetite. So we knew, just roll up the sleeves with all of our team, know we can get through the pain points and, you know, hopefully come out the other side, which we did.
Yeah. I remembered one of our investors' advisors I was speaking to at the time, and he just said, you know, how the management team behaves in this period, you know, that's going to be really testament to your success and your story. And that kind of stuck with me, because I think, you know, we really faced into it and we brought the investors along the journey of those few months. But when we were able to demonstrate at the end of that year that we had taken the business into profit, you know, and kind of really changed, like you're talking from a marketing perspective, we went from like 10% contribution margin to like plus 30.
What does that mean?
So it means, like, you know, basically your margin post your marketing costs, right? So we tripled our efficiency. They had then, you know, very, I suppose, trust and conviction again in what we were doing. And thankfully then they bridged us and we raised more money from them, which kind of brought us into, allowed us to kind of just focus on growth coming into 23. You know, and which was an excellent year for the business. We doubled the business, you know, and did it profitably, and then we were able to raise more money again, you know, towards the end of last year. So, but you know, I think everyone has these stories along their journey, and I think that they do, you know, as difficult as they are at the time, I think they do make you a better business, and effectively, I suppose you have to be resilient. You never know what's around the corner. Like, you know, we're doing well, but we're still a small business. So I think that they, you know, they stand to you.
You've stress tested it in probably the most extreme ways possible. So you've raised multiple times since. I think the traits of the good founders that I have honored, they're all good storytellers. Not just externally, but internally as well. They're able to bring people on the journey with them, whether it's investors or whether it's staff. So what's been, aside from that, like, what's been the most difficult moment for you personally, Adrian? Like, what's been the biggest challenge you found of being a founder?
I think early on when we were at around our seed investment. So if you look at where you are now versus where you were then, you're much more resilient, you're much more tough, you're able to deal with it. But having left a very secure job and then you're trying to raise that funding, and you don't know where it's potentially coming from, but you can see the costs up ahead of you. I definitely found that very hard to deal with at the start, because I was like conscious that we had to pay bills. And that was something I found hard to deal with. But over time, you know, I learned how to cope with it and the mechanisms. And now I think you can be much more understanding that what you do in your business, it's not life or death. And as long as you're clear in what you're doing and you communicate with everybody, without your investors, your customers, or your team, you will get there in the end and just persevere. But at the start, I find that difficult. But that was probably my main thing, yeah.
You talked about it there. You touched on it. It's not life or death. Like, so how do you manage the personal and the professional? Like, how do you balance? So we talk about body, business, and brain on this podcast for specific reasons. How do you balance those? Like, how do you, like...
Yeah, you definitely need to have a clear separation from home and business, although my wife might not say in terms of how much I could talk about it at times. But it's ensuring, you know, I have a young son, Freddie, he's 9 months old, making sure, you know, every day when I finish work, I spend time with him, I get outside, exercise when I can. But it's really important to have your family and your friends around you and, you know, just doing things you enjoy, because, you know, I think I heard on a podcast recently, and I fully agree with this, it's like you're working to live, not the other way around. So I think that's really important for me. And I love socializing. And, you know, that's what I like to do in my spare time as well.
And Will, how do you balance it?
I think pretty similar to Adrian. I would say family first, and like we had a baby 14 months ago, Liam. That's, you know, definitely has been such a change, but a positive change, and you now need to be very present, you know, with them, and very conscious of that they don't miss that time, because it goes so quickly. So I think, you know, being present and spending time with family, and also making sure your friends and your friendships, like, they're so important as well to, you know, keep timing, and they kind of bring you outside of the business and give you a release, even though you don't realize that's not the purpose of it, but that's what you're getting out of it. I think aside from that, just, you know, exercising for me, you know, keeping fit, and reading non-business books as well to kind of take your mind into other places. Yeah, it's probably socializing that's covered in the friend part. But yeah, that's...
So you both had a lot of transition in the last kind of couple of years. Freddie fought 9 months.
Yeah.
And your son is...
Yeah, Liam's 40, just almost 14 months.
That's a lot of transition in a rapidly scaling business.
Yeah.
Did it help that you both had children at the same time?
I suppose, well, you went first in terms of I was seeing kind of the impact, and you're able to understand, okay, there's a big change on the way. I think people tell you you're going to experience a change, but until it actually happens, and then just supportive partners and family, like, you know, both our families have been amazing at helping us be able to do it. So, yeah, I think it's a lot of change, but it also helps your mind become incredibly focused. So when you're in work, you're like, I am 10 tasks to do today. I'm going to get them all done, and I'm not going to procrastinate. So it actually helps you become more efficient.
Yeah. It is like, there's purpose as well in terms of, like, for me, it'd be around family, a lot of, like, you know, family opportunities in terms of maybe your personal goals. You know, I think a kid, you know, brings another level up in that. But definitely less time to be floating around thinking about work. You kind of just got to get in and get to it. So I think it would have been a different challenge if we had, you know, dependents. Our chief commercial officer, Angus, he used to always say, you know, when we were starting off, Angus had a couple of kids, you know, and he was saying, you know, it's, you know, you're starting a business without dependents, which is, you know, it's probably easier. I still think you can start a business with dependents. I think you probably just need to have good people around you as well, and a good team to work with you, because you can't be everywhere if you're trying to be present with the family as well.
Yeah, I think you both touched on it there in different ways. You have to be ruthless with your time, because they have to go to bed at a certain time. They have to go to crash. They have to get picked up. You know, you have to spend that time, and you want to spend that time with them. So I would agree. It's definitely made me more time conscious and better when I am working. When I'm working, I'm working. Whereas before, you'd be like, I'll do a bit now and I'll do a bit later. And you whip up the laptop at 8 o'clock. Yeah. You just don't do that anymore. So Sons is an incredible name, but would indicate that you've broader ambitions, do you?
Within,
like, Sons is
within
quite a...
healthcare?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we've taken a very conscious decision to stay in a single category, you know, and left a lot of revenue on the table in doing it. I mean, there's a lot of money to be made now in indications, like, you know, we chose not to go into erectile dysfunction. We chose not to go into obesity, into testosterone, which, you know, I think for us, we feel... going back to the original kind of business idea that there is and there is no and hasn't been a brand for a consumer brand for hair loss that's relatable and really motivate guys to take action in that area. And we want Suns to be that, you know, in every channel, in each of the markets that we play. And we think that if you go into other health indications, that it's more difficult to be synonymous with that one. So, you know, that's we have big plans, but they're more around channel and market expansion.
Mm.
So, you know, we're probably in the last year and a half with retail, started our strategy. We're now, you know, we've over 1,200 distribution points. You know, we're 600 booths between the UK and Ireland, a couple of hundred super drugs. So it's really about, you know, scaling that out. We launched into Germany in September last year, and really exciting market. We're getting about 70 new customers a day in Germany. So it's about now trying to become the market leader in that market as well. We're on track in UK and Ireland, and then doing it in more European markets. That's really what our grand plans in the next kind of, I suppose, 18 to 24 months are.
And what, like, is it extremely difficult to launch a new territory? Like, is it hard? Because obviously different language, different, like, probably different channels. Like, how hard is it to do?
Yeah, so from Germany in particular, that was a very challenging project in that EU regulation isn't fully homogenized, Germany being probably one of the most challenging markets. So we had to do a lot of research and invest a lot from a legal and a regulatory perspective to ensure our business model was fully compliant. So, you know,
why did you go there? Sorry, what was the original?
So largest market from a commercial opportunity, plus the regulation allows you to execute the model in Germany, whereas in France, we couldn't have this same direct model as an example.
Gotcha.
And again, it was similar when we're having to focus on profitability, we're having to invest a lot to really understand the regulation and the legal elements before generating any revenue. But now that we're in there again, that's built a moat and a really robust business model to allow us to scale in that market as well.
Okay. So it's weird that it's not homogenized. I nearly tripped over my words there. It's weird that it's not like, okay, you're in Ireland, that means you can go to Spain, Portugal, Italy, Germany. They're all different, are they?
They are. I think regulation is changing around kind of e-prescription and direct mail delivery. And it likely will homogenize because that's really where the patient is going. And you know, certainly there's a lot of cases for if you look at like aging population and making it easier for them to get their medicines. So we do expect that'll happen. And, you know, as part of our strategy, you know, we're staying very close to that. And, you know, the other markets, like in particularly in Southern Europe, we do expect to homogenize. But it's not there yet. And I think, you know, probably.
Yeah, I think like there's a real place for online in healthcare. If you look all across the world, healthcare systems, GP waiting lists, you know, a GP doesn't want to be seeing someone that has hair loss. So why hair loss and a number of other conditions? Why can't you homogenize that and bring it online? The drugs are safe. The model's validated in the UK. It's very advanced in the US. So I suppose we remain hopeful that the UK and Germany have led in that way, as is up the US, that we can have homogenized example. Ireland is slowly getting there, albeit there's still some resistance on the model, but hopefully over time it will.
What do you mean resistance on the model?
I think it's more a traditional market. So our strategy in Ireland is more focused on the retail setting, where we have Boots as our largest part of our business. The online model in Ireland just isn't as evolved, so there's resistance there to allow delivery of prescription medicines.
Okay. It does seem like a business of the future, though. It does seem like this is how it's all going to go, right? And I think COVID accelerated a lot of that.
Yeah,
in terms
COVID
of people's
has been
thinking
fantastic
like,
on that.
Like some things just don't make sense, right? Queuing up, go to a GP just for a problem that's not like an urgent medical need. I think people's attitudes are changing, or I'm always very conscious to go, not everything's like you, but like, is that true that people are getting more focused on the preventive side of things?
Yeah, from a preventative medicine perspective, we're seeing not just in hair loss, but on all personal care, people are trying to stay ahead of things, especially with the younger generation. So I suppose if you look at it clinically, when your hair is gone, you know, it's very hard to do something about it unless you want a very expensive hair transplant. Whereas if you slowly adopt the treatments and, you know, get into a routine, you can actually prevent that from happening over time. So the sooner you treat the problem or the condition, the more likely you are to see a benefit and a result.
So like, What would you love to see like happen across Ireland in terms of getting people more aware, less stigmatized? Like what do we need to do as a nation to kind of like get a bit more health conscious?
I think it's not just in hair loss. It's, you know, it's that openness of a conversation. I think there's a lot of brands now focusing on taboo subjects. So how can we, number one, encourage the conversation to people be proactive about things and not procrastinate? And then filtering down, how can we be more healthy in our lifestyle? Obesity is becoming a major problem. So how do we improve diet, exercise? And then we need the government and, you know, the regulatory bodies to ensure that they will come along in that journey and ensure that we can drive convenience and accessibility, because mm-hmm. that still remains a challenge for people.
Mm. Like the model of subscription as well. It seems like it's going to be one that's going to grow and grow and grow. I get my coffee on subscription now. Like stuff like that you buy all the time. It doesn't make sense not to be getting it just to your door regularly. Like,
hopefully you're listening to the pod and you're feeling inspired. Maybe you want to do new things in your own business, or maybe you have that brilliant idea you've always wanted to bring a little bit further and see if it works. So why not right now? You listen to the majority of the guests in this show, and they've been helped by the local enterprise office at some stage in the journey. They have something for everybody. Whether you have that idea you want to develop, you want to get your products to new markets, you want to innovate your existing products, or you want to expand staff and premises, they have the supports to help. So why not today? If you want to start up or grow your business, then contact your local enterprise office today.
Personally then, like talk to me about like how you look after yourselves, because we talk about the body and the brain, like we touched on earlier in terms of fitness and workout, but what things do you do as non-negotiables to look after your brain and your body?
I start with brain and go back to just trying to read, you know, and read stuff that isn't specifically business to try and, you know, switch off from it. I think body is exercise and diet. So, you know,
give me some specifics in terms of things that you do for your diet that make it good.
I think I would be conscious of getting your veg intake, you know, and your fruit intake. And when that has become more of a challenge time-wise, reference my son. I've signed up to a subscription with Huel around their kind of their greens supplement, which I take every morning. And, you know, I just try and be conscious not to eat out too frequently. Try and, you know, home cook meals as much as we can. So I think from a diet perspective, that's what I do. You know, love coffee, but try not to drink too much of it.
Dazzle us with some science, Adrian. Give us the scientific insights here.
Yeah, no, I think like it's time is always the challenge, but you have to make time for yourself in order to perform. And I think it's exercise, you know, two or three times a week, albeit with a newborn, being realistic, that always doesn't happen. And then
your sleep's a killer.
Exactly.
My daughter's 19 months now and she's still a little bit fluctuating on sleep. It's the one thing I can't kind of control.
Well, yeah, in fairness to Freddie, he has been brilliant and that's helped a lot getting that routine back. And then for me, I love like sports is a really big relief for me in terms of whether it's playing or watching. I just really can like get into that and really focus on it. And that really takes my mind out of it. So I think we've been lucky with Ireland doing quite well in golf and rugby, and the Gaelic recently has been amazing. So I find that a huge outlet for me, and it just kind of gets me away from everything.
Mm. And then talk to me about like the future. Like what does the future hold for sons?
I think,
what's the big ambition kind of 18, 24 months out?
I think just from the product side first, and then Will can go a little bit into the commercial, where we're not just, you know, focusing on the hair loss product specifically. So we're launching a new dandruff medication at the moment, because again, it's a really close to hair. It's a taboo subject. We're also trying to always identify new product opportunities that can, you know, we have something for everybody. There's so much we can do in the German market. As I said, it's like the largest market. We've set up a really interesting business model, and further afield, we're looking at, you know, what can we do in Amazon in the US and all of those opportunities. So we operationally, we've put the structures in place to be able to do that. And then hopefully that'll translate into some interesting numbers.
Mm. Will, give me yours before we hit our quick fire round.
Yeah. I think from a customer side, you know, we probably this year would treat, you know, north of 150,000 guys. I think we see that, you know, over the next 3 years, we want to treat, you know, over 1 million. Probably category leader from a, you know, a online e-com site in UK and Ireland. It's now about doing that in retail as well. So number one positioning in the likes of Boots, Superdrug, you know, Irish Pharmacy channel is a really exciting channel. So, you know, doing that here as well. And in Germany is a big market for us. So we got in, that's doing really well. So replicating what we've done in the UK and Ireland then. I think we'll probably do another 2 to 3 markets in Europe in the next kind of 24 months. Certainly Holland, we're looking at Sweden as well. Top line level for us, it's about being the category leader in each of the territories we play in. So I think by doing that, we should say in kind of 2-3 years time, we should be in that position in Europe.
Cool. We'll do a quick fire round. First, I want to know your founder formula for success. Obviously, it's called the Entrepreneur Experiment. I'm trying to figure out the perfect formula for success. So I'll ask you individually, what's your founder formula for success? So Adrian, I'll start with you.
I think the lived experience has been very important to that, because you really understand what the consumer is feeling, whether that's the self-esteem, the confidence, and then from your prior experience, industry knowledge. You know, if you know a sector, really go after it, and I think that can help you.
So personal experience plus industry knowledge equals success. Will?
You got to go first, you fecker.
Individual. No, they're all personal, so it could be anything.
Look, I think from relative to our own story. I think the being very close to the problem or the opportunity can help a lot. So like lived experience. It doesn't have to necessarily be lived experience, but I think understanding the problem or the opportunity that you're going to or trying to address. I think the other one that I would say is around curiosity and optimism. I think as, you know, as a founder, consistently looking at like how you grow and how your business grows is a formula to success. I think we consistently bring back things to the business from when we meet people, right? We meet people and they mightn't be in the same industry, but they're doing something interesting. You bring that in and you're agile enough to be able to do something and with that idea. And I think that is something that, you know, I would embody. Adrian also does as well, and I think that's definitely been a formula to success.
Definitely. Thank you very much. A quick fire round. What book would you recommend every entrepreneur read, Adrian?
I really enjoyed the one by Phil Knight, the Nike Founding book, in terms of it became just really helped me understand the graft of what you have to do and the lengths to get there from, you know, he flew all over the world with an idea to get there. And then I think it articulated the challenges of scaling, and, you know, no day is easy. So I really enjoyed that one.
Shoe Dog. Will?
Currently reading a book, Good to Great, that I've just started, which I think is, you know, focused on, you know, businesses, how you win in the long term. And it's a lot of it's around, you know, kind of that focus. And I've taken a lot of relevance in terms of our strategy. So
Good to Great. What's something you'd learn the hard way?
Learn the hard way was probably the time and effort on certain parts of the business to get it right. So you go in with an assumption at times, being optimistic as entrepreneurs, that it'll, you know, take a short period of time, but you have to be quite realistic in terms of, you know, how long it will take to get there.
Well,
I think learn the hard way, probably focus. You know, I think when you're starting off and things start to work, you automatically think you should go everywhere, and you can maybe ignore how much you can get from just being very focused on what's working now and doing more of that. So I think probably learn that the hard way.
Focus. I like it. What's something you've sacrificed to achieve your success?
I think you definitely have to let things socially go, in terms of, you know, really, you know, bringing in that focus into your life. You still get to do most things, but you just, you know, at times there's going to be have to sacrifice you make, because, you know, you need to get a project on or you need to get something. So yeah, you have to make social sacrifices at times.
Yeah, I think pretty similar over the last few years. I'd say not a huge amount of holidays. I'd say social holidays, has been something.
What would you do today if you could be €10 million?
Invest it in Suns.
Most common answer. No, give me a balance. You can invest some of it, but not all of it.
I think, yeah, there's so many interesting companies out there in Ireland at the moment, and we're both lucky to be part of the EY Entrepreneur scheme this year and just have seen so many really interesting companies. So I think there's a lot of interesting Irish-based companies that you could invest in.
Yeah. One
in particular that I really was impressed by, it's a company, Fire. It's developing a heart failure device. The CEO, Conor Hanley, really, really impressive guy, and it's entering pivotal trials in the US, so it could gain approval in a multi-billion dollar market. And what really impressed me about that was Conor's optimism, his ability to tell the story, and a company from Ireland, you know, really going after the US and global scale. So his ambitions is to IPO that company, and, you know, really impressed by him.
Love it. Thanks. I hadn't heard about that one. Will, what would you do today if I give you €10 million?
I think, like, if you're looking at it from investing in a business perspective, I'd say again, you know, there's so many, we've been exposed to so many great Irish businesses in the very recent past, a lot of it through that EOI Entrepreneur of the Year program. There's a litter of those you could invest in. If you're going to put me on the spot again, there's a really interesting business, Embryonics, which is there's a family in Galway, two brothers and a sister, the Mackies, and they're developing lasers to go onto satellites, so effectively building the internet in space. And, you know, learning that they're, you know, winning against, you know, US, German companies. So
I did not think you were going to say lasers to go on a satellite there. Sounds like a Dr. Evil thing. Yeah, going to get a giant laser.
That's it. Yeah. So, I thought it was pretty cool that you have a, you know, a business in Galway that's, you know, competing, you know, at that stage on a global scale. So again, I think that's a business that could absolutely blow up.
That's class, and I haven't heard of it either. What's something in your daily routine you wish you started sooner?
I think that balance, actually, since having a newborn Freddie in the family, were those times where, you know, you would just let the evenings go on and you just constantly work because you didn't have that focus. So that structure has really helped me in terms of just, you know, knowing when I need to get things done. Mm-hmm. And then that's freed up personal mind, which then, you know, you come back in the next day and are, you know, better at what you do.
Will, what's something in your daily routine you wish you started sooner?
I wouldn't say daily. I think it's probably a bit further out than that, but it's just planning my time and saying no to things. You know, we have less time now, and then, okay, this is relevant to where we're at now. We have more people, but it's delegating and stepping away from certain things. So I think just you know, more proactively managing my time.
Mm. If you were to start a new company in the morning, what would it be?
Probably come back to, you know, very focused on health. And I think there's a lot of interesting things happening and trends around the aging population and moving away from one drug for all conditions, and how can you deliver other services around the treatment. So that could be counselling, that could be, you know, apps to improve compliance. So really, I think there's a lot of interesting things around fertility, testosterone in men. I'm really interested in that space.
Okay. Will, what would you start in the morning if you start a new company?
Right now, I think based on what we're picking up along the way, I think, again, it's just, you know, we probably know a lot about, you know, health, and from, again, what, you know, what you can disrupt through digital. And then I would say through the, you know, doing it through a, you know, a brand, so a lifestyle brand, so you could take conditions. I mean, there's stuff within obesity, for example, which is a massive issue that I think that there's, you know, business there and that. From a female perspective, you know, hair loss, you know, so there's, I think it would probably be something in that space, albeit we're not thinking about that right now.
Try to give people a few ideas if they're listening to something that could start.
A lot more to do.
What do you believe that other people find strange or strongly disagree with?
They disagree with me personally. Mm. That's a difficult question. Probably sometimes in in work, it may be your like approach to things in terms of, I think since starting a company, you probably have to digest things and move quite quickly, fast. And sometimes people would find it hard to understand how I got to that point. So taking a step back and really trying, taking time to explain, that's, yeah, I'm not sure exactly on that one.
Will?
Give me the question again. Yeah.
So what do you believe that people find strange or strongly disagree with you on?
I think that I feel that I am self-aware to an extent, my messaging at times is probably could be more collaborative. We've actually just gone through our kind of half year reviews with the team, so we ask for feedback as well.
Okay.
From them in those sessions, which was it consistent? So it's probably just my awareness of I think Adrian, myself, and actually being friends starting a business, like one of our values, like the business down to earth and being humble. And I probably then feel that I can maybe speak to the team the same way I might speak to Adrian.
But actually,
that person may take what I've said in a different context.
Context matters. I was just going to say that. Yeah, I get you.
So that's I think, feedback that I've been given and I'm taking on board.
Oh, see, there's the listener now. They're like, he is listening. Yeah. What's one thing in your personal life you spend money on that brings you immense happiness?
I think holidays with your family, because you can fully detach from work and just spend uninterrupted time. That's a big one for me in terms of we as a family love to get away and do things whenever we can.
Mm. Do you have a favourite spot?
In Ireland, where we love Donegal, we're going this weekend, and although the weather's never great, it's just nice to be quite remote and go on beach walks and, just have, we don't have Wi-Fi where we stay generally, and it kind of just allows you to detach. So
nice.
That's quite a good thing.
Will, what do you spend money on that brings you immense happiness?
I think probably just eating out with the family, getting less probably evening date nights at the moment or for the last.
We do breakfast now. That's our new go-to.
That's what I was going to say.
It's the new hack.
That's what I'm going to. So
breakfast.
Breakfast or, brunch. And that's, at the weekend I could do a lot of that. So
yeah. Breakfast is the hack. Me and wife every month do a life breakfast. We sit down, just us.
Love it.
And it's cool. What's your final piece of advice to any entrepreneur or aspiring entrepreneur listening?
I think the focus element has been something that we really benefited from. So, you have an idea and, you really focus in on it and understand as much as you can about that opportunity by speaking to people and doing your research is really important, and avoid distraction, which, as entrepreneurs, you see lots of opportunities. Mm. So just stay focused on that roadmap until you deliver it.
Will?
For me, I'd say for anyone starting out, really understand the problem you're addressing, and then you can conceptualize that into what's the business or the brand that maybe you're challenging that exists already, because there'll always be something in the space, even if it isn't exactly what you're looking at. Try and really understand that, and then I think validate it. We spoke about doing our survey with 100 people. Try and validate it with your network, and don't be afraid to meet people in the industry, meet competitors and ask them about what you're going to do, because we found people are always willing to share information.
Yeah, it's amazing. People are far more open than you think they'd ever be. Where can people learn more about Sons?
The easiest way is on sons.ie or sons.co.uk.
Perfect. Adrian, Will, thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Gary.
Thanks, Gary.